Well, Nehemiah in Nehemiah chapter 2 comes over as very passionate for the things of God and the things of the restoration of the kingdom. But he also comes over as very weak. He takes up the wine and gives it to the king. Well, what a contrast with Daniel, who, as an exile, he wouldn't touch the king's wine, let alone get into a position of authority where he had to taste it before the king did. So from that point of view, Nehemiah is thrown up in contrast with Daniel. And you wonder what on earth he's doing this job anyway. Well, this would have been around the time of Esther. And I think the book of Esther has a sad ending, really, because the Jews are popular. They're in positions of authority. Mordecai, he's named after Marduk. Mardukai is a Jew, but he's totally assimilated. And his great dream is that his adopted daughter Esther, or possibly his niece, would be the queen. And, well, we know how it all worked out. God worked through it, but it's all a picture of spiritual weakness. It's mentioned that the queen was sitting by the king here, and that, of course, makes us wonder whether it was Esther. It doesn't say that, and the chronology of this time is hopelessly jumbled. The Septuagint in verse 1 says, I took up the wine and gave it to the king, and there was not another before him. Nehemiah was alone with the king and queen, and the Persian queens weren't usually enthroned when formal meetings were held. So this was a kind of a private audience. And there's a lot of similarities with Esther, who I read as a secular Jewess who was not particularly spiritually minded. She wanted to be the queen, when it was not surely an appropriate position for someone with a fine conscience towards the God of Israel. She agrees to sleep with the king, and he checks her out and thinks she's the best, and so she gets chosen to be the queen. Well, yeah, this is all not exactly very committed spiritual behavior, and it contrasts all the way through with Daniel. And the connections are more, I think, between Nehemiah and Esther, really. All the way through, really. And he is weak. Nehemiah is weak, and yet he's also strong in his passion for the things of the kingdom. And this is the point I want to develop. See, in verse 8, he asks for a letter, really. According to provide him with everything, he says, according, verse 8, to the good hand of my God upon me. But Ezra, exactly because of the good hand of my God upon me, Ezra 8:22, refused to ask for soldiers to accompany him. Well, Nehemiah had the same good hand of my God upon me, but he asks for soldiers and is given them. So he is contrasted with Ezra, he's contrasted with Daniel, and the similarities, I think, are with Esther, who was the weak secular Jewess who was used by God. Well, as I say, there's a lot of similarities with Esther. Verse 4, the king said to me, for what do you make request? Well, that's exactly what the king said to Esther. And we think of how Esther came before the king in sackcloth, which she wasn't supposed to do. That's in her second appeal to the king, for the not just for her salvation, but for the reversal of the decree for the rest of the Jews. And it's a bit like Nehemiah being sad in the presence of the king, which he wasn't supposed to be. Well, as I say, these are the negative sides. What are the positive sides of him at this time? Well, when the king says in verse 4, for what do you make request? I prayed to the God of heaven, and I said to the king, if it pleases the king, send me to Judah. Well, I prayed to the God of heaven. Well, surely he prayed with his eyes open, just in a flash, before he spoke. That was just an instant prayer of, a second or two. And it reached the God of heaven. So he clearly was going in God's strength. And I suppose the Jews of his time were encouraged to pray directly to the God of heaven because the temple was in ruins. And in the time when the temple was in ruins, they realized there's no point praying towards the temple, as Solomon had told them to when they were in exile, and God being gracious to them in captivity, because the temple was no more. So it was the removal of religious structure which led him, and many others hopefully, to a direct relationship with the God who is in heaven. Not praying to the Jerusalem temple, but to the God who is in heaven. And you take a lesson from that, that there are times when religious structure has to be removed from around you so that you come to God in spirit and truth. And you come to that direct relationship with him. It may be by a transfer at work that transfers you away from the town where you've always gone to church. It could be that things go belly up in your church life and you get chucked out, or the church breaks up, or whatever. And the removal of that religious structure is all in God's good hand to bring you to a direct personal relationship with him. Well, Nehemiah is sad, and the king says to him in the Septuagint in verse 2, "Why is your countenance sad, and why don't you control yourself?" In other words, you're not supposed to come to me sad, like Esther was not supposed to wear the sackcloth when she came before the king. You're supposed to be all upbeat and everything's just awesome, etc. This was clearly, on Nehemiah's part, an absolutely uncontrollable passion and sorrow. And he's sorrowful because you can work out, I think, that comparing with chapter 1, that 4 months before that, his relative Hanani has come to him and told him that Jerusalem is in ruins. And when he says in verse 3, "Why shouldn't my face be sad when the city, the place of my father's tombs, lies waste and its gates are consumed with fire?" Well, actually, he's not actually talking about what the Babylonians had done, but I think the work of the Samaritans in knocking down what had been done so far. Well, the fact that the king says, "Look, you're sad, you're supposed to be sad, can't you control yourself?" And he says, "Well, why shouldn't I be sad?" This is almost rude, but he's speaking absolutely from the heart, and he sort of blurts it all out, just like Esther does, in not a very politically correct way, but absolutely from the heart. And as I say, that the queen sitting by the king, verse 6, the implication is we're to imagine her nudging him under the ribs, saying, "Yeah, yeah, agree to what the bloke asks." And it's tempting, as I say, to think that this was Esther, or at least some Jewess, or somebody pro the cause of the Jews. Well, Nehemiah, in my opinion, finally doesn't work out. According to Jewish tradition, he returns to Persia, and I don't think he quite lived up to the potential that he maybe had. So my point is that on one hand, he is absolutely devoted to the things of God, and he's prayerful, and he has great undoubted passion for the tragedy of others, which was so great that he could not hide it, even at the point when he was really supposed to hide it. And yet, on the other hand, he was weak, he was working as the cupbearer to the king, he was tasting the king's wine, involved in idolatry, whereas Daniel wasn't. He wants the soldiers to go with him when he goes back there, even though he says, "The good hand of my God was upon me." Ezra didn't do that. So he's weak and strong at the same time. And this is my point. This is my point, that we can get very down because of our own failures and our own weakness and lack of faith and spirituality, whilst at the same time passionately believing. It's not to say that all our other feelings, or our weak feelings and our weak aspects of our lives are somehow not important, and we haven't got to worry about them as long as your basic heart is passionate for God. No, I'm not saying that. I'm not trying to justify weakness in any form, but I'm saying that this is unfortunately how we are, and we shall die imperfect, just as many of the faithful people in the Bible, like Samson and Jacob, Josiah, the three examples that come to my mind, who all at the point of their death, died saying and doing things which were not really ideal spiritually in terms of obedience to God, in terms of having what later would be called the Spirit of Christ. And yet, God says that he accepts them. So we shall all die imperfect. And this perspective also helps you to cope with the immaturities of others, which of course we see far clearer than we see our own imperfections. They too shall not die perfect, just as you and I shall not die perfect. And what we're asked, I think, to understand is that a person can be spiritually weak and strong at the same time. This is why you cannot judge. We cannot judge exactly because we don't have that psychological penetration into other people's hearts that God alone has. And you must not judge because you actually cannot judge. You think you can, but you cannot. And it's no good saying, but we are to judge as far as we can. Well, you can't judge, and that's the finish, end of. And you see here how somebody can be weak and strong at the same time. Paul felt something of that in Romans 7. And we all have this in us. And it is how we are, and it is how our brethren are. And we long for the kingdom, don't we, when that weaker side will be no more. But I repeat that I am not justifying that weaker side. I am not saying that we should be complacent to our weaknesses, nor that, as it were, my passion for this aspect of God's truth or that aspect will somehow cancel out and atone, as it were, for my less spiritual aspects or my weaker aspects. No, that is not how it goes. That is not how we should be reasoning. But I'm simply observing what is, like it or not, the reality about all of us. And you see it in Nehemiah here. And will he be saved? Well, we don't know. But we're saying that at this particular point, he has an undoubted passion for the things of God, and he is prayerful, and he's presented as that. And he so often talks about my God. So although his whole religious structure had been removed because the temple had been destroyed, yet he still has this direct relationship with God, even though on a surface level he is involved with idolatry because he is drinking the king's wine, which is exactly what Daniel refused to do in the same context. So, weak and strong at the same time. This is how we are. And I'm saying this to help us towards a greater self-understanding and a greater understanding, I hope, of how God looks at people in outline terms. And he is so positive, he looks at the positive more than on the negative, as it were, and to help us thereby to be patient likewise with our brethren when we see their weak side. This does not mean that they do not also have a better spiritual side at the same time.